We're talking with author Deanne Stillman, 29 Palms, A True Story of Murder, Marines, and the Mojave. And that song could be appropriate for the part of the book we'll get more into just a second, the actual story of what happened to this 16-year-old and this 21-year-old woman whose lives collided with a mixed-up, to give them the benefit of the doubt, an evil Marine, to probably be more accurate. There was a moment, you kind of just feel for it almost. It's just, you know, the sense of don't do it. When one of the women was coming up to a place that she was looking to rent, and Rosie said to her mother, "Hey, Ma, what do you think?" It was a little L-shaped apartment block. Nothing big, nothing fancy, but clean. At first look, the mother felt a knot in her gut. Something about the place felt evil. "I don't know," she said. "I was hoping maybe you could find a place near Jessalyn." "Come on," Rosie said, heading for number 7. It beats the Philippines. And maybe that's part of what so much of the story is about. It's always just trying to stay one step ahead of something else that was worse, until there were no more steps to be taken. We'll tell you more about it next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We'll run the numbers at the bottom of the hour so you can join the conversation starting in a few minutes, and then we'll do open lines in the final hour of Coast to Coast AM. In for George Knapp tonight, this is Ian Punnett. And Deanne Stillman's been talking about 29 Palms. We also mentioned earlier her other books, Desert Reckoning is another, and of course, she's written books just about the other things, about the historical events in the Mojave as well. But the story, I mean, the crux of the story is that on August 2nd, 1991, this Marine who returned from the Gulf War repeatedly stabs two young women, one 16, one 20. 1 years old, savagely rapes and murders these girls in a certain apartment on a certain knife. How did it happen that everybody came together for this event? And that's what Deanne Stillman has been able to track. How was it that the Marines helped in helping to sort this all out?
Well, it's a pretty grim part of the story. Each girl was stabbed 33 times, and it turned out that the killer was, as I mentioned earlier, a basketball player and quite a good one, and he had idolized Patrick Ewing in the NBA, whose number was 33, and he also played on the one of the local rec league basketball teams, along with some other Marines, and one of the NCIS investigators who happened to have been on the team and looking into that crime put it all together when he knew that this guy's number, his own number on the Marine team, was 33 because of Patrick Ewing. And here these two girls had been stabbed 33 times each. And by that time, when this NCIS investigator put that part of the story together, the suspect in the killings had been taken into custody because his hand was bleeding. Hmm. I think he was arrested at a basketball game, actually. Hmm. And then they started running blood tests and DNA tests and discovered his DNA all over Rosie's house, this little bungalow that you were mentioning earlier. Yeah. And that's how it all was put together, because this NCIS investigator was on the same basketball team as the killer and recognized the number the number 33.
You've seen the little bungalow?
Yeah.
What was it about it that you think triggered her mom, as I read there, to have such a negative reaction to that little apartment?
Well, that little apartment seemed to be at the center of one very evil vortex, I have to say. There was a very bad feeling there. It was just kind of a wretched little pad, not so unusual for a certain part of town. I think I described it in my book as it was part of a compound. I described it as an Anheuser-Busch colony on the edge of nowhere.
Right.
And I said that because there was a biker gang nearby, and there were often, empty six packs discarded in the driveway, and there was said to be, there were other crimes that I found out later that had happened in the same bungalow, and I compared it to, the desert has an ecosystem, as we were talking about earlier. And there are like generations of snakes which return to the same lair, and everybody has their stomping grounds, and certain people are attracted to certain kind of locations for certain reasons, and there's that mysterious X factor, and that place really had it in a bad way.
Almost a kind of, as we talk about with snakes or with these toads and frogs that come up after the rain, that it's an instinct. It may not be anything that anybody could articulate, much in the same way that that the mother of one of the victims had an instinctual reaction to the building without knowing anything about its history, without knowing anything about what had gone on in there. There were just certain visual clues.
That's somebody right. It just didn't feel right. It was an assault on the senses in every way.
But, somebody mentioned last week when I was talking with M.L. Bierman about some of the things that he's seen or heard about and some of the stories that he tells about the Mojave in his video series and in his books. And some people wonder whether there aren't some kind of energy lines that run through an area like that, like almost like a bad juju or something that is out there. Is that a kind of thing that you ever would look into? Because I'm almost anticipating someone's going to mention that when we
calls. I'm sure those lines run through the desert for better and for worse. I mean, I use that phrase a lot, but I really mean it. I mean, I've felt some very strong energy lines out there in a very invigorating way, in a life enhancing way. But I mean, there are some places that I've definitely wanted to steer clear of and have. My book starts and ends with an earthquake. I have in the beginning of my book, there was that passage that you read, and then that section ends with the desert talking and saying, one of these days I might have to shut the whole thing down.
Right. Well,
at the end of my book, in the epilogue, I end with live fire exercises going on at the base, they happened to have been carried out on a fault line. And the fault line went off in the middle of those exercises. And I believe a couple of Marines were killed that day. Mm. It might have been the Landers quake, wasn't it? I have to look it up.
I'd have to look it up too.
Yeah. It was quite a strong quake. That fault line, I don't even know if it had been discovered prior to that moment. But, imagine this thing going off in the, a major fault line going off in the middle of live fire exercises. So it's interesting that it happened as I was finishing my book. I mean, it was a strange yeah. echo of how I had started.
A book
with the desert announcing its intentions, and then it was like, yeah. Oh my God! And then this quake, the whole place erupted, and it kind of confirmed my own personal, Old Testament interpretation of
right.
of the place.
And that's where I go back to an hour ago when I couldn't help but have this feeling, because since so many of the people that you write about in the story were women, and the generations of single women who were fighting for a better life for their kids, mm-hmm. and you know, the rape victim 6 weeks before the girls were raped and murdered, that rape victim, all she wanted to do is get back to her son, was just whatever it took to get back to her son. And these very dedicated moms, some of whom weren't making good life choices. In their dedication, they might have been dealing a certain amount of drugs. They might have been taking some other chances with their lives. But it seemed like that their heart was in the right place and they really were trying. And as you mentioned earlier, some women were literally raising like generations of kids or other people's kids and inviting other women into their apartment because they needed, you know, they felt for strays and orphans, whether it was a dog or a person, they just felt like they needed to show that kind of love. But at the same time, you take those smart women, some of whom were very industrious, willing to work, and you take them and you put them 100 miles in a different direction. And the story, one would think, would just have turned out very differently, that there's just something about the way that the Mojave, especially in these dusty, desperate towns, and I'm not saying 29 Palms is bereft of any hope, because there's a lot of commerce there and many people I'm sure live there happily, but there's a reason why some of these things keep happening. And I couldn't help but think these same women would be prospering under slightly different, you know, conditions and slightly different geography.
Well, it's true, and as I was saying earlier, the families I chronicle the girls had this legacy of poverty and violence that went back for generations. And they were just not able to shake that.
Yeah.
Yes, given other circumstances, maybe they could have, but it just all caught up with them in the desert. And I have this during all of my travels through this story, I came across the tale of an ancient petroglyph, a jackal on a rock out there in the desert. And jackals really did not roam that part of the desert, but here was this mythical jackal, you know, on a rock, apparently. And the image that occurred to me, that there was this jackal hounding these families across time, and they just really could not outrun it. Real tragedy to me, because to me the girls were patriots.
Right.
The Marines have this saying that they never leave a body on the field, but these girls really had been left on the field, and here they were taking care of Marines, kissing them goodbye when they went off to war, welcoming them home, cooking for them, partying with them, and in the case of Mandy and Rosie, you know, ending up being killed by one of them.
Yeah.
You know, so the girls who do that, who perform that function, and the girls and women and men, to, you know, whoever it is in these military towns, are really unsung patriots. They're part of the military community, part of the American community.
Sure.
And, you know, they're down there in the hold, you know, taking
right.
care of every of the whole thing, really.
Yeah,
that's really why I wanted to tell the stories of Mandy and Rosie. Well, you know, who were these girls left on the field, and like, who was this so-called trash in town?
It makes you wonder about self-fulfilling prophecy, though, too. In
mm-hmm.
that, you know, that
they,
at what point is the story that they're telling themselves? Does anybody? How often is our own personal narrative what drives our own conclusion? And as you mentioned yourself, you had started in kind of a riches to rags story. At some point, you make conscious decisions that you're going to do certain things that will define your future, and you are successful. But other people might have a very different reaction, and some bad things happen, and they become, you know, convinced that this is all that they'll ever be good at, or this is all that they'll ever be able to have. And that's what drives it. That's ultimately, in the end, that's all that happens.
Well, that's true. I mean, I was fortunate in that I always knew I wanted to be a writer, and my parents encouraged that, and I was given every active support along that path, regardless of economic circumstances. So that was, you know, I think my parents realized that was my gift and nurtured it. There are kids whose gifts go unrecognized. That just doesn't happen. I mean, one of the most amazing, that's kind of such an overused term these days, but I have to say one of the most heartbreaking and actually at the same time thrilling things I've ever seen in my life was a year after Mandy and Rosie had been killed, Mandy's mother, Debbie, who was this former biker chick and starting over in 29 Palms, tending bar and taking care of all of these kids, decided to have a fundraiser in the name of her daughter, Mandy, to help an average girl get out of town. And all she needed to do was raise $1,000 and give that away as a scholarship. So there was an incredible party at one of the local bars, and people over a period of weeks contributed, like bar tips and matchbook collections and welfare and food stamps and stuff like that. When the $1,000 was, when that goal was met, that Debbie threw this great bar party with a local band, and girls wrote essays about what they would do with the $1,000 if they won, how they would proceed with their lives. And Debbie chose an essay, and it was read in the middle of this really joyful and raucous bar classic Mojave bar party. I mean, that's like one of the great things about the desert. There are these very fierce and amazing and beautiful parties with all sorts of hard rock, including Hotel California, like you were just playing.
Yeah, of course.
And that was a year after Mandy had been killed. And it was just beautiful and heartbreaking. You know, imagine trying to raise $1,000 to help an average girl get out of town.
Mm.
That's really all it took. You know, there it was, right in the middle of the desert. That's kind of the whole story.
You know, there's that old Quranic saying that you save one person, and you save the world.
Right.
And that's definitely the theme of that. Well, let's throw up the numbers here, because Deanne Stillman was only able to give us a couple of hours, but I want to be able to leave some time here for other people to join in the conversation, both about the Mojave, the deadly aspects of the Mojave, but also 29 Palms, this particular true crime story that she tells so beautifully in the book, 29 Palms, A True Story of Murder, Marines, and the Mojave, which you can find more about by linking up. We barely touched on Desert Reckoning. We'll do that coming up in just a minute or two. We'll get into that book as well. So we'll shoot you the numbers next. Pick one, join in the conversation. And in the last hour, we'll do open lines. But if you go to coasttocoastam.com, take a look at that amulet, the photos of the amulet that we were talking about last week. We'll put that up there, too, in case anybody can offer us any insights as to what that's all about, too. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. So we're lining up the calls right now. We had a couple of people already hanging on with some interesting experiences of their own out in the desert. They want to connect with Deanne Stillman. You can too. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. You'll find out more about Deanne Stillman. Link up to her at coasttocoastam.com. Other great stories up there too, including George Knapp's story that probably took him away from the mic tonight. I'm filling in for him. Robert is in the AZ in Phoenix on the wild card line for Deanne Stillman on Coast to Coast. Robert?
Yes, Ian. I'm your old security guard.
Oh, Robert! Roberto!
Yeah.
Hey, buddy, it's good to hear your voice.
Good to hear yours, too. Real quick, now, want to thank your guests for giving women who have been victimized, especially in small towns, a voice. I mean, seriously, they're forgotten. But real quickly, as she looked at the triangle between 29 Palms, Las Vegas, Yuma, and back up, which is mostly military ground, because there's a lot of people, especially women, hitchhiking, who have disappeared that section. And I'm not trying to diminish the military, but there are guys out there who still go hunting, who haven't left the battlefield behind.
Yeah, and Dia, yeah, Robert, think, don't go anywhere yet.
I'm sorry, what, Ian?
I was just going to ask Robert to hang on, because I want to hear what you have to say, but I have a follow-up for Robert. So go ahead, Deanne.
Oh, hello?
Yeah, just hang on, Robert. I just want to make sure you don't leave, because I want to get Deanne's response to you, and then I have a follow-up for you. Deanne, your thought?
First, Robert, thanks so much for your comments about my work. I really appreciate that. In terms of that triangle you mentioned, I haven't really looked into it. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. I don't really cruise around for these kind of stories. This particular story hit me a certain way, at a certain time in my life. At a certain moment, I walked into that bar and it resonated for very personal reasons, and also because I love the desert. I don't want to minimize that. I think it's it's played a very big role in my life in all sorts of sustaining ways. And Joshua Tree National Park is one of my favorite places in the whole world. That being said, there are certainly treacherous areas in the desert. The Mojave is pretty notorious for it. I think some of the disappeared girls and women that you're talking about and whom Ian named earlier have been picked up and killed, may have been prostitutes and may have been picked up, you know, for sex and killed en route to wherever or not. That's not my theory. That's a theory that a number of law enforcement agencies have put forward, and it makes a lot of sense, and that's why you rarely hear about we rarely hear their names or even hear about these incidents. Because I'm writing about some kids who were castaways. They were not unknown in their community.
Right.
The people you're mentioning are like beyond, truly have been castaway in every way. So it's kind of, they're just really on the outer limits as far as cultural recognition goes, which is a shame, but it's not something, and I appreciate your asking me about it. It's a story that deserves to be told. It's not, if you explore my work further and go on my website and read essays about why I write the things I write, I don't cruise around for these kind of stories, and there have to be certain elements involved, and there are in every story that I tell. That's how it works for me.
You know, the in some cases, I had been following up when I was reading about the list of women that I read off earlier, and I had been reading from the news articles that were written about them. And to your point, of course, we don't know everything about all of the women that I mentioned, but many of them were just driving through. And they were driving from one place to another place. They were just doing it at a time when one sheriff's deputy I spoke to in San Bernardino County said, there's a suspicion that there are some people out there who are waiting along the highway. And they just simply, they wait until they see somebody go by that they find interesting. And this is one suspicion, is that they just run these women off the road. And there's nobody around to see it. There's nobody around to, and that's why they often find the cars with nobody in them later on. They merely take them from there.
Look, it's conceivable. I mean, I've been pulled over a couple of times on remote desert roads by cops, and that's been scary too.
Yeah, exactly. And that was an authority.
Who knows? Yeah, it's just, be careful out there, as somebody once said.
Yeah.
There are, you know, there are these missing women. That's a fact. Other people have put forward the theory that maybe it's long-distance truckers who are responsible for a lot of these,
right,
you know, crimes.
Yeah. Abductions. Robert, I just wanted to say,
yeah.
Robert was the security guy at a building where I was living when I first moved to Phoenix, and he was very instructive to me and helped give me the lay of the land. And Robert, remember when I was first making the drive up to Vegas for, I had an academic conference I was supposed to
yes.
go to, and you were like, you were telling me, like, look out for the cops around Wickenburg, which goes through my head all the time because there's all those speed traps around Wickenburg. But you also told me about, you know, driving at night on those two-lane stretches between, you know, north of Wickenburg going up to, you know, Kingman and up to all the way up to Las Vegas. And that's what was going through my mind when I was reading about this 29 Palms Highway, which is the deadliest highway in the United States, the deadliest stretch of highway, US 62, in the Mojave, for just the same reasons that you mentioned to me. It's a lot of people crossing over the median in the middle of the night, and there's nowhere to go.
Well, it's fun to drive fast on the open road. Isn't that our birthright? One of them anyway.
Right.
You know, born to be wild, all of that, pedal to the metal. I mean, that's where America lives, driving fast. So, you know, that's kind of.
As long as you stay in your lane, though, and that's where, you know, as you mentioned in the book, you know, you've got this, you know, great Marine base there where the huge chunk of the population is under 21. And you've got men, you know, young men between 18 and 21, densely populated in an area. And they're already the most dangerous drivers on the road, according to, you know, insurance actuaries. So,
well, yeah, you've got jacked up young men who can take advantage of dollar drink night and on Marine payday. So, yeah, I mean, trouble ensues.
Robert, good to hear your voice, Robert. Let me get to Joe, who's in Long Island, for Deanne Stillman on Coast to Coast AM.
Yeah,
Joe?
I have two quick questions. One, I had read, I believe, in the Inquirer a while back, something about fake casting calls, luring women into, like, maybe B-level Hollywood films that were supposedly shot in the Mojave Desert, and it was actually a setup for them. And then my second question was, you know, how extensively did you hike that area? And those Old Testament references that you were speaking of, would that be Hagar in the desert or Elijah as he was fleeing Jezebel, something like that?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, what I mean by that is first of all, the Joshua tree, which is a personal totem for me. You know, it's this, it's named after the prophet Joshua. That's not why it's a totem, but I just happen to be drawn to it. It's kind of sort of like this beautiful but freaky radar station that's frozen in time and receiving messages and sending out at the same time. But to the Mormons who were, when they came west, according to the story about the tree's naming, when they first saw it, they thought it was the prophet Joshua pointing to the Holy Land. So they named it the Joshua tree and thought they were heading towards Salt Lake City, and they did it. They got there at some point, but that wasn't the way the tree was pointing.
Hiking.
So, I mean, there's that element, the Joshua tree and all that conjures, you know, marking the Holy Land. And then just that the desert, it's a sacred space. I mean, you have all these miracles of nature happening there. That's kind of really what I'm alluding to. And then these voices coming through, you know, good, evil, and everything in between, and it's kind of this alluring melody that plays, and you know, it's just there, you know, and in certain times of the year, it's just a gorgeous place, depending on the angle of light, and you know, the winds, and the constellations and everything. There's an element of the sacred that runs through my book. You'll see if you read it, through all my work, place as a character in all of my work, and how people move through it.
So Joe also asked about how extensively you've hiked the area.
Oh, yeah, a lot. I've hiked a lot in the desert, especially in Joshua Tree, and, you know, other parts of the West. But I it's just one of my favorite places, the park. So have you hiked in the park?
I'm not sure that we...
Ian and or the caller?
Joe, go ahead. I think you're still there, right?
Yeah, I hiked a lot in Glacier National Park and in Alaska, you know, two very remote spots. And it's unbelievable in Glacier Park how you get on what were essentially like ledges on supposed trails. So I can relate to wild hikes, so to speak.
Yeah, it's amazing, right?
Yeah. Joe, thank you. And I've got Mel standing by. I just want to make sure we get time for both of our remaining callers for the end. Stillman, Mel is in the Mojave as we speak. Is that right, Mel?
Yes, sir, I am.
Where are you with all of this conversation?
Well, you know, I've lived out here my entire life. And, you know, to me, I can't say it's all related to the Marines being out there and everything. I mean, we have Marines out there for decades before these disappearances happen, you know. That's my opinion. But I will say there's always been rumors of cults down in that area, satanic-type cults. I've had my own run-in with a couple of guys out in the desert one night where it became necessary to arm myself. And things do happen out there. You can go back to the Laura Bradbury disappearance, the child that disappeared in Joshua Tree there. Your writer probably remembers that one. But these things, and the influx of methamphetamines.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
for sure.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
In the early 80s, I remember when it just started out, you know, and then it just perpetuated and exploded out there. And, but, you know, I think the desert gets kind of a bad rap, you know, but look at the influx of people that have moved out into the desert over the past few decades. I mean, you got places like Victorville, Apple Valley, Hesperia, that were all really nice, low crime rates at one time, and look at them now. I mean, just the...
No, I agree with you. I mean, that, you know, the economy has forced people who are barely hanging on, you know, out into areas that are affordable. So, I mean, there's that. But then also, as I was saying earlier, that, and as you just said, the desert, you know, often gets a bad rap. There's a lot of beauty and you know, fantastic people who live in it. This is a cliche, but some of my best friends live in the desert. But, yeah, I mean, there are, you know, anything goes. You know, we're all, it's miners' law prevails. As we were discussing earlier, you know, in the second book of mine that Ian was going to get into, Desert Reckoning, that is about a hermit who lived in the Antelope Valley north of L.A. And, you know, also that's the Western Mojave, and killed a cop who showed up at his trailer one day, a guy whom he had a grudge against that went back for 10 years due to a prior run-in. But the cop that he killed was the lone cop in that area. And, you know, that's a very dangerous job for cops, because if you want to be the solo, you know, law enforcement agent in a remote place like that, you need backup, chances are it's going to get there too late. So, you know, everybody really is kind of left to their own devices. But something I do get into in Desert Reckoning and in 29 Palms too is how much a lot of the characters love the desert or just dependent on it in every way. You know, it's a salvation for a lot of people, and it also can destroy you.
Chris is in Rancho Cucamonga. Chris, you're talking with the author Deanne Stillman, 29 Palms.
Yeah, Ian, it's good to hear from you again. I haven't heard from you in a long time. Remember you mentioned you had that issue.
Yes, thank you.
And you went off the air, so it's nice to hear you again. Yeah, I used to live out in Beaumont, which is not too far from 29 Palms, and I would drive through that 62 every time I go to Las Vegas. They call it, it's actually the low desert. But I was also in law enforcement, too, out there for quite some time. But one of the issues they had out there is a big influx of prostitution. So with the Marine base you had out there that's going on, you have a big market for girls that are from other places, mainly Las Vegas. They come down there for prostitution. And then one of the other callers also mentioned meth. That was a big thing as well. If you just go off to 29 Palms, it's actually a pretty scary place. There's a lot of abandoned houses out there and abandoned shacks and abandoned places where I've always wondered just by driving through that, I mean, what's underneath there? If you're looking for, you know, girls or individuals or just people that are deceased and missing, I mean, there's a lot of places out there that just by driving by in these broken down houses and shacks, there's something going on over there.
Gets you
and
wondering.
It is quite a scary place in some regards, but in a lot of ways, the Marine base brings in some, you know, in unfortunate manners, this type of crime, because that's just the nature of the military in some cases.
Chris, appreciate that comment. I'm going to leave a little time for David. Deanne, did you want to respond anything in particular to that before I get to David?
No, I think those are all good points. You know, the military in the desert is a huge source of income, and it's and everything that comes with that. Everything this caller was talking about.
Like any oasis in the desert, it's going to attract both predators and prey.
Right. And, exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
Well put.
David's in Tucson, and so he had a thought on this, and then we'll wrap things up with Deanne Stillman. David.
Hi, yeah, great show. I'd like to just say that I heard once that a culture resembles its zip code. And I grew up in Tucson in the desert, and everything here has a thorn on it. It's a very thorny place with all the cactus. And it tends to be a very thorny environment culturally.
That's interesting. And, that's really interesting.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
I grew up here, and I found two dead bodies before I was 15 years old out riding my dirt bike. And then they excavated an old drive-in theater, a popular drive-in theater called Cactus Drive-In, and they excavated it to build something new, and they found the dead body there.
Oh,
and we're finding dead bodies here my whole life in this desert region. And like you say, it's beautiful. But boy, does it hide things! And
it's a deadly beauty, David. This is the time we have left, and thank you, Deanne Stillman. Thank you for especially for making us time. I know you had an arduous week. 29 Palms: A True Story of Murder, Marines, and the Mojave, and so much more. Find out more by going to coasttocoastam.com. You were a delight. Thank you so much, and we'll do open lines for the last hour. We'll crank up the numbers next. Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.